Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everyone. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our week in review. Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, is with us. Good to have you. Always nice to have you in, Arlene.
Nice
thanks for
to
coming
be here.
In.
Thank you.
Also with us is Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Hey, Charlie, good to see you.
Good to be here.
So let's begin with presidential politics. We just heard from Congressman Seth Moulton, who says he's still trying to decide whether or not to run for the White House. Charlie, let me start with you. I guess the question is, jumping into such a crowded field, how does someone like Seth Moulton stand out? What do you think?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think he does. And I like Seth Moulton, but I think he's got a couple of problems. You know, part of his brand is his service and being a veteran, and he's sort of blocked there by Pete Buttigieg, and the other piece is the other problem I think he faces, just from a PR political point of view, is that I don't think he came out of his whole sort of fight against Nancy Pelosi looking very, very good and having made a lot of friends, and so I don't think he's facing a great landscape if he wants to get in.
Yeah, what do you think, Arlene? I mean, he did do that. He did take on Nancy Pelosi as part of his campaign for newer, younger leadership. Nancy Pelosi arguably prevailed. Did that injure him in terms of his potential quest for the White House?
That's exactly right. I mean, I think there's a lot to recommend Seth, but I think he is injured is precisely the word I was going to use right now. He's wounded. So I think he's not quite ready for prime time until those wounds are healed.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about some of the rest of the field. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is very much running for president. Monday is the deadline for presidential candidates to report their first quarter fundraising. Warren's numbers were, people might say, kind of middle of the road. She raised $6 million in the first 3 months. Compare that to Bernie Sanders, $18 million, Kamala Harris, $12 million, Beto O'Rourke, $10 million. Charlie, what do you make of these numbers? Are we wrong to be focusing on numbers, and should we only be talking about issues? But what do you think?
Well, in a perfect world, we should always be talking about issues, but we don't live in a perfect world. So,
Seth just accused me of asking a political question, that's the nature of politics.
That's what we're here for. That's right. Well, I would say this. I would say that, her fundraising has not been overwhelming. I think that more problematic for her, in my view, is this poll that just came out that showed her in third place in Massachusetts. So I would say that her campaign has not gotten off to a strong start, but I would also say that it's still the start. I mean, there's a whole lot of time for that to change. I don't think things have been great so far, but, let's see how things look 6 months from now, 9 months from now.
Yeah. What are you seeing, Arlene, in the Elizabeth Warren campaign so far?
Well, I think that there are so many people in the race. My head spins. I do this for a living, and I can't keep up or keep track of all the people who have gotten into the race. So people with big names and big ideas like Elizabeth Warren will have an advantage no matter what, both in fundraising and in the podiums that they'll be given. But we've got miles to go before we rest on this, and there's so much that's going to happen. Money is one of the metrics that does matter. If you have none, you ain't going anywhere.
Right.
But she's well within the comfort zone on that one. So the question is how it's going to play itself out. One of the things I say to many of my political allies is be critical of the Democrats that you wish to criticize, but keep in mind that we're going to have to support one of them at the end of the day.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, she is still sort of on the field with those numbers. And it's worth pointing out that she raised that money without the big donors that she's staying away from.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. That's right. Which is pretty significant, because any candidate that makes it into the final run-up will get the big donors.
On the other hand, I want to ask you about this, and this is something we've talked about a couple of times, and I've done some reporting on. I mean, she's really distinguished herself in the Democratic field as the person who's working really hard on policy and putting out a lot of policy.
Yeah.
Today, so she calls this the real corporate profits tax, a 7% tax on the largest, most profitable U.S. companies, could raise $1 trillion in a decade. She's put out an initiative to combat corruption, break up Facebook and other tech giants, universal pre-care and child care, a wealthy tax on the very rich. I mean, a lot of sort of careful policy work, big proposals, but arguably sort of big plans about how to pay for it. But is it making a difference? I mean, you mentioned it's sort of middling in the polls. So what do you think, Charlie?
Well,
in other words, do people at this point, are they paying attention to policy? Does it matter? I wish it mattered more.
Well, sadly, I would take that a step further and say, you know, do they ever really pay attention to policy? You know, look, you know, in my little world of people who care about this stuff, you know, I think she should really be applauded for what she's done, because she really has tried to come out with serious, a series of very serious policy, proposals. And I think that's great. I don't know how much it's going to matter, because I don't know how much policy really matters.
And this makes me sad, Arlene. What do you think?
It makes me sad, too.
As a political consultant, I mean.
She is the brilliance of Elizabeth Warren is that not only are her ideas serious and pithy and real, even if you disagree with them, there's real substance there. She'll be changing the nature of the debate in this campaign for all the candidates. Mm-hmm. Because even if someone disagrees with her, they're going to have to explain how and why and what's the flaw in her policy. And she will be able to back it up with facts and figures in a way that most candidates can't. So she will be helping both to frame the nature of the political campaign's debates and change them.
So I want to ask you about another Democrat who's getting a lot of attention in the last couple of weeks, and that's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. He's not officially running yet. My understanding is he may be announcing this weekend, but he's already creating a lot of buzz. 37 years old, an Afghanistan war veteran, Christian, openly gay, new polls, not worth much at this early stage, I want to stress, but I'm still going to mention it. New polls from both Iowa and New Hampshire have him running in third place. What do you make of the Buttigieg bump, Charlie?
Well, I think it's very impressive, and I think he's a very impressive candidate. The thing that is impossible to know at this point is, you know, is it the beginning of something even bigger, or is it, you know, I remember a few years ago, you know, we had for a time, Herman Cain and Michelle Bachmann and, right, you know, all these people, you know, and they're, you can barely remember them now. I don't know if that's going to be the case with Buttigieg, or if this is just the beginning of something that's going to be longer lasting. I would say that, you know, from what I've seen of him until now, he is certainly an impressive candidate.
Well, I want to ask you as well, Arlene, but let's listen to a little bit of Buttigieg. So here he is last Sunday at an LGBTQ event in Washington.
I can tell you that if me being gay was a choice, it was a choice that was made far, far above my pay grade. And that's the thing I wish the Mike Pences of the world would understand. That if you got a problem with who I am, your problem is not with me. Your quarrel, sir, is with my creator.
And here's Vice President Pence responding to that idea on CNBC.
I worked very closely with Mayor Pete when I was governor of the state of Indiana. We had a great working relationship. And he said some things that are critical of my Christian faith and about me personally, and he knows better.
Arlene, what do you make of this? I mean, Buttigieg expresses himself so well, but this full-throated linkage that he made there of who he is and his Christian faith, I mean, it really comes across as authentic. What's your response to that?
I thought it was brilliant. It's a line that a lot of us have been repeating again and again, because he combines being very smart and insightful with humor. And saying to the Mike Pences of the world that if you have a problem with who I am, take it up with my creator is a brilliant way of summing it up.
And it also brings together issues that don't normally get brought together, because we normally in the political world associate faith with conservatives.
Exactly.
And, you know, and this guy is saying, well, no, that's not how it necessarily works. You know, and I think he's going to make people think. As I said, I think he's very impressive.
Yeah, he's really impressive. I look forward to seeing more of him as I go up and down and cover the campaign up in New Hampshire as we move closer to the primary up there. Lots to talk about in the months ahead in the world of politics, so in presidential politics. So let's move on, though, because I want to shift gears and talk about this clash, I guess you could call it, between Governor Charlie Baker's administration and Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins. Today is her 100th day in office. She was elected last year on a promise of change, including ending prosecutions of 15 low-level crimes. She released a 65-page memo outlining her plans to do that. But Governor Baker is not in love with the idea. Here's a little bit of what he said.
You send a really bad message, not just to people who might potentially do those sorts of things, but you send a really bad message to the people who would be on the receiving end of that type of behavior.
So a little more background about sort of what played out this week. Late last week, the governor's public safety secretary, Thomas Turco, took aim at Rollins policies in a two-page letter saying they'll substantially restrict government's ability to protect victims. And Rollins responded this way.
Not everyone gets the benefit of the Baker family when they have interacted with the criminal justice system. Most moms that are living in Suffolk County don't have a $1,000 lawyer to handle a charge when it's brought against their son or daughter or loved one.
Now, since then, Turco and Rollins met. They described it as a positive discussion, and both Baker and Rollins have spoken. The governor says they're going to hit the reset button. But, Arlene, what do you make of this back and forth between the Republican governor and the Democratic DA?
It's been fascinating. On the one hand, I think that her positions are brilliantly insightful. She ran on that platform. It's why my kids and I voted for her, among other reasons. And she's raising in really important public policy questions about the fact that arrest and incarceration are not effective solutions, for example, for substance abuse. And a lot of these low-level nonviolent crimes are clogging up the system and are really as much about racial and socioeconomic disparities as anything. Mm-hmm. You know, on the Baker issue, I don't blame him one iota for doing everything he can to take care and help his son. Any good parent would do that, and I think he's a good dad for doing it. But when that back and forth took place with him, I thought immediately of something Barney Frank said around gay issues years ago when we had gay closeted legislators who were voting against our community. And he came up with a brilliant expression. Barney said that you have the right to privacy, but you don't have the right to hypocrisy. And so I think there's applicability in this context.
Interesting. Interesting. Charlie, what's your takeaway from this?
Well, I tell you, I view it two ways. On one hand, I just happen to have been doing a lot of work recently for governing on this whole criminal justice reform stuff. And I think it is absolutely clear at this point that this, you know, mandatory minimums, mass incarceration from a policy point of view clearly has not worked.
Right.
And I think that in some cases, you know, maybe I might quibble with some of the details of what she put forward, but the general ideas that she's putting forward, you know, I think, generally speaking, I probably agree with. What I was troubled by, though, and this is using the Lord's name in vain here, because there's something almost Trumpian about her behavior here.
Explain
because,
that.
Because what I found so odd was that, to react so strongly to some criticism and then go into this thing where the thing that really got me, not so much the Baker thing, although that was inappropriate and she shouldn't have done it, but when she goes after Maura Healey, because Maura Healey, who was CC'd on the memo, apparently hadn't read it and made a public comment. I mean, she sort of needs to get herself under control a little bit here, I think, or she's just going to be shooting herself in the foot in terms of the policy, the policy goals that she wants to achieve.
Well, on the other hand, so here on Radio Boston, we spoke to Kevin Burke. He's a former state public safety secretary and also the Essex County District Attorney. And from his perspective, having held both jobs, he thinks it was strange that Turco weighed in on this. Here's what he said.
It's extraordinary. And I can't think of instances where secretaries get involved in district attorneys' policies. And it's also extraordinary that a secretary would make such a public pronouncement, but it shouldn't happen that way.
So, I mean, I guess the question shouldn't this have happened behind closed doors?
I would agree with that. I think that's absolutely right. But I just felt like D.A. Rollins' response was sort of unglued to the whole thing.
I disagree on that one, Charlie. I think it was fiery. It's true. It was passionate. There was a degree of self-righteousness, but I think she was right. I think she was right to be self-righteous. The criticism was not only factually inaccurate, but it was trying to do a public shaming of her and her policies, which from its get-go, it was egregiously inappropriate. And he was stepping out of his arena. And he was foraying into an area where he knows much less than she does. He was talking about her neighborhood, not his own neighborhood. And she knows a heck of a lot more than he does. And as a bottom line, she understands very well, perhaps he may not yet, hopefully he's changed, understand that the people who benefit from the current system are overwhelmingly wealthy and privileged.
And I think that's right. And I don't disagree with that. But there's just, and I guess I'm looking at it more from the sort of the PR point of view and how it's going to be perceived. You know, these comments about, well, how come Maura Healey has not responded to, you know, it's like, it's very much like, you know, I'm the center of the universe, and why isn't everybody paying attention to me? You know,
well, I think the message it will send is that people will not foray into to strong criticisms publicly about her policies without A, first talking to her, and B, without knowing what they're talking about, because she won't abide fools, which is a great statement.
All right, well, let's move on, because there's another big story I want to talk about from this week, and that is more than 30,000 Stop and Shop workers are on strike throughout New England. They walked off the job yesterday afternoon after months of negotiations failed to produce a new labor contract. So union officials say health care is a central issue, specifically the amount of money employees are being asked to contribute to their premiums. Other issues include pension benefits and the use of automation in the company's stores. So here's Matt Sorbello, a union leader at Stop and Shop, talking to us earlier this week.
The company holds Delahaye's made over $2 billion in profits. That's profits last year alone. And they want to take a lot of stuff away from us. Got our health care, got the pension, decreased time and a half on Sunday. Nothing for any new people coming into the company. I mean, there's really no incentive to work here.
So in a statement, Stop and Shop says, we are committed to good faith bargaining and hope to reach new contracts as quickly as possible. Other than that, we haven't heard a whole lot from Stop and Shop. But start with you, Arlene. Arlene, what's your read on this strike?
This is fascinating because if you see the television ads for Stop and Shop, it seems like it sounds like such an intimate and local company. And in the days when Deb Goldberg's family ran it, I think it was, in fact, that. But it is now a worldwide conglomerate. Dutch-owned, fourth largest in the United States.
Ahold Delhaize, is that what it's called?
I couldn't pronounce it myself.
I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right.
That was very brave of you to try.
I'm fluent Dutch speaker.
Oh, really? Whoa. Glad you tried it. So, you know, as he said, they're making a $2 billion profit, and they benefited to the tune of $250 million in a tax cut, thanks to the Donald Trump tax cut. And yet they are doing this egregiously bad corporate behavior to do this to their employees when they have clearly made a lot of money themselves. You know, most of the people, if you work for Stop and Shop at this level and you have two kids, 10 to 1, you're right at the poverty line, which is disgraceful. So these workers are our neighbors. They live in our communities. They need our help. So candidly, I'm not shopping at Stop and Shop right now until this strike is resolved.
So here's Senator Elizabeth Warren. She joined striking workers this morning in Somerville.
You know, these giant companies think they can knock unions back. They think they can push us back. But what they have to understand is unions are here to stay.
Yeah.
Unions will fight back.
Charlie, what are you seeing in this latest strike, this big strike against Stop and Shop?
Well, look, I mean, I think that, you know, you've got the fact of the matter is that both Stop and Shop and the unions have an interest in Stop and Shop remaining competitive. And, you know, there's a healthy tension there between the union and the company. And I feel like they'll come up with something that they can both live with. I guess the only issue in it that I think is that strikes me as odd in any way is the issue around the automation. I mean, that strikes me as that sort of strikes me as around...
You mean worker concerned around the development of automation.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it reminds me of back in the day, the issues around NAFTA. Like somehow if you change the policy, you can stop globalization from happening. Well, you can't. And you know, to say that you're going to be able to stop the increased use of automation, I mean, I think that's sort of that's a tough one. I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, on that point, here's Jim Cavallo. He's political director for Local 1445 of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, talking to WBUR.
I think a lot of people will look at this automation in any sense and say, well, that's the future and that's, you know, decades away. But we feel, and I feel, that this is actually a lot closer to our doorstep than a lot of people realize.
Yeah, so he was referring there to the so-called MARTI robots, which the idea is they're going to roam the stores looking for issues and obviously displacing real workers. But anyway, listen, we've got to move on because we're going to run out of time, and I want to make sure we leave time for our hubbubs, those brief stories that or events that caught our attention this week. Arlene, what was your hubbub this week?
Well, a neighbor of mine, Ania Carmago, wrote something in the Beacon Hill Times about methane gas leaks all over the downtown Boston and Beacon Hill, just as one example. They even had a map of it there. And she talked about how National Grid knows about these gas leaks under the street, how the gas leaks are killing trees because they're suffocating them, and that there are like 3,000 of these gas leaks all over greater Boston, but National Grid and the utilities are not required to fix them. So if you think that they're killing trees, you can only imagine what it's doing to those of us who have to breathe in this air as well, to humans. And we know that it's these methane gases, bad for asthma, bad for respiratory health. It's got toxins from fracking gas. I learned all of this from the article. And interestingly, what I didn't know is that apparently methane gas is 80 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than a lot of fossil fuels. So I'm grateful to neighbors who are paying attention to this and activists who are fighting it so that for Arbor Day, rather than buying gas masks for our trees, we can advocate for better policy.
Here, here. So into 3,000 methane leaks.
Good Isn't Lord, that something?
3,000. Yeah. Charlie, your hubbub.
Well, I would say that I actually know about methane only because my son has been preaching to me about it, my 18-year-old son, for years now. My hubbub will reveal a significantly lower IQ than Arlene's. Apple products have a security feature that kicks in whenever somebody repeatedly types in the wrong password. And the more times an incorrect password is entered, the more time, the longer the lockout grows. And if you want to know more about this feature, you might want to talk to Evan Osnos, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker and a Brookings Institution fellow. After his 3-year-old spent some quality time with Osnos' iPad, he got a message on his screen that said that the device was disabled, and it informed him that it would remain so for a number of minutes that added up to more than 48 years. And after Osnos tweeted the story out, he got some very helpful comments about how to save it, which included reboot the 3-year-old, and my personal favorite, which was time travel seems to be your best bet.
I like that. Well, look, here's mine. It comes courtesy of Steve Anier at the Boston Globe, who wrote this week about a truly alarming attack by wild turkeys in Cambridge. Did you see this?
Yes.
On a pregnant woman named Kenda Carlson. Now, the story seems comical at first, but then it sort of evokes Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. I mean, because this poor woman was approached by a couple of turkeys, then a few more. They crossed the street. They surrounded her. They began to peck at her, and she literally couldn't get away until a neighbor showed up with a broom to chase these aggressive birds away. Kenda Carlson has been taken to carrying this large umbrella when she's out walking and posted on social media, be careful, especially if they're making direct eye contact with you. I didn't know that about turkeys. Now, but again, this is serious. If you read the article, you have a lot of sympathy for Kenda Carlson, what she went through. But wildlife officials say this isn't uncommon, particularly in spring, which is mating season when turkeys can be more aggressive. So this is when they apparently try to even the score for Thanksgiving. This is mine. Anyway, Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Thanks, Charlie. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thank you, Arlene. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.